Welcome back to ADHD Money Talk, the show that helps dynamic but distracted ADHD brains take back control over their money in order to stress less and live a more enriching life and open up new and amazing possibilities. And I am your humble and very ADHD host, Dave DeWitt. And today is episode number 2 of my 3-part series of my interview with Dr. Russell Ramsey. And we're going to talk about pre-rehearsing behaviors you want to happen before the thing that's going to happen that causes you to sabotage yourself happens. Does that make sense? I don't even know. He'll explain it much better than I can. We'll also talk about how ADHD can affect our sense of self. It's just a really great interview. And so here's part 2. And next week we'll have part 3. Okay, let's get right back into the interview with Dr. Russell Ramsey, who, by the way, just so happens to be the co-founder and clinical director of the University of Pennsylvania's Adult ADHD Treatment and Research Program and an associate professor of clinical psychology at the Perelman School of Medicine at Penn. So he's got an incredible resume. He's doing awesome things. And the book, Rethinking Adult ADHD, was incredible. So please check out that book. Let's get back to the interview. One thing you said, just understanding ahead of time your pitfalls right, so you can catch it early. With spending, yes, it is the number one thing I hear. It's whenever, you know, someone fills out the form to talk with me, it's what's your primary concern? Impulsive spending. And the way that I try and help people with impulsive spending is first trying to make the future thing that they actually want more salient, like more tangible. The exercise of actually picturing yourself in 10 years and waking up and getting out of bed and what do you want to see around you, making a vision board, whatever, so you can see it. But it always still comes back to, even if the vision board was at home, you go to Target, you're walking in Target, it's not right there. You see the thing you want. It's still so easy to pick it up, go to the register and buy it. So I'm always tripped up as the strategies oftentimes require you in the moment to remember, to have the pause to ask yourself, is this really providing value to my life? You know, should I buy this? But then how do you actually remember to do that? And maybe it's just a matter of practice and just failure and you do it and you don't, and then just like getting better incrementally rather than just like, I have to do it every time. And if I don't, I'm a failure kind of thing.
Well, it's a combination. I mean, what you described with the vision board, externalizing information rather than carrying it around the motivation in our head, externalizing motivation. And Russ Barkley and Tom Brown have made careers of talking about this and the scaffolding. There can be a variety of other, and these are all effortful. And these are hassles, and people can say, I shouldn't have to do this. My neighbor doesn't have to do it. My sister or sister-in-law doesn't have to do it. And there can be some guilt and shame with it, even though when we look closer, a lot of people, like I mentioned, the automatic deduction of payroll for retirement funds, people set it up. There's been some research in countries who, like for a driver's license, they'll automatically include you for donor donations, but you can unclick it. But even this is the opposite of one-click shopping. This is one-click declining organ donation, which is easy enough to do. But if people there, no, that works. That's good. I'll do it. And I'll just keep it. They exponentially increases. So these sort of self-regulatory external things help. Like one of the things in dealing with technology as an analogy and bring it back to the financial then, yeah, we talk about turning on the device with a plan. So if a student's going to the library to work on homework, now these are verbal rules. We can violate them. While I'm here, I'm going to work on this homework assignment for 30 minutes. I'm going to log on to the class website, but for the time being, I'm only opening the windows. I need it for the library to download an article, my word processing software, I have that open. And when I'm done with this, then I can log on to other things. Or it could be having the plan, the shopping list of walking into Target. It could be, you know what, I'm going to do online shopping, which has its own difficulties. If I'm doing a targeted search for impulsive online spending, logging out each time you use it, so you have to log back in as another couple clicks you have to do as an inhibitory delay. Having your partner, having somebody come with you to go shopping together so you can each play the conscience, or at least come to a consensus. Yes, this thing that we weren't going to buy, this is a good sale. We agree that we're going to get it. Now, two people can be wrong, but at least it slows it down. And externalizing the information, even talking about it, it's inhibitory in terms of it slowing it down. And like I said, logging on to the online retailer, just it takes a little more time. It's effortful. And as you're typing things in, hey, I'm doing this to buy this thing. Do I really need this? And there are the old school things like the delay rule. Can I wait until my partner gets home and run it by them? You know, if they're in addition to vision boards, are there other sorts of maybe habitual things in your wallet or with your credit cards? There's a little sticky note that says, do you really want to buy this? Whatever, that brings it into the moment as best we can. And yeah, maybe even things like not using the Apple Pay or other, you know, portable. And again, some of these are very convenient and I understand why you'd want to have them and nothing's going to be perfect, but just in ways to slow things down, externalize the motivation and the plan, like you said, and having some positives, like before you buy something, check your savings account and see, because even getting to benchmarks, oh, it's at 998. I'm almost at 1,000. I don't want to bring it down.
Yeah, I like that. Now, one thing that I know from my own experience, whenever I try a new thing to help me curb my own spending or to make a change, it always works for a couple of weeks. And if I had a sticker on my credit card, it would work. It would be exciting for a couple of weeks. Ultimately, my brain would say, you know, I don't like you having the sticker anymore. So we're just going to pretend it's not there. And then I can find myself just completely ignoring it. I could literally use that card for a year and actually have never truly just looked at it and read that line. It's right. Like my brain is pre-setting that. Like it's so smart. It's so tricky. It's pre-sabotages you. So if that's the case, is there anything that you can do? Is it more maybe work of truly reframing the why?
Well, I would say even going back to some of the externalized tricks, or after a while, like people have sticky notes on their laptop or whatever. After a while, it becomes like the furniture where you see it, you know, it's there, but you're really not looking at it. Like I'm sure they're like wall hangs or everything. I know they're there, but I really haven't looked closely to appreciate. It's nothing to some IKEA stuff, but it's still interesting enough. But you see it, but you don't look at it. So we can habituate to anything. So there might be new things like putting a rubber band around them. Or I've heard extreme examples, right? People with extreme spending problems. And it's sort of old school where we load our credit cards on our phone, then we don't really actually need them anymore. But it would like be putting it and like freezing it in a block of ice or something. So it would have to melt before you could use it. But even keeping them in places or drawers where you have to go in and maybe it's a locked little lockbox that you have to put in the 3-digit code for, that it just creates delay. You know, so apart from any of the externalized things, and you mentioned something, even the externalized goal for what we want to have, you know, the positive goal of what we're working towards. But going back to the valuation and the why, you know, what are we doing and why? Yeah, I think with practice, it can be helpful. And especially if spending, just like exercise or sleep, is a targeted goal. So it increases the likelihood, never perfect, but that even talking about some of the behaviors, the sequence of behaviors that go into spending, it could be going out to the store, logging on to the online store, whatever it is, and the little tricks of, you know, even in some places, if you're not going out, not having your credit cards with you, it's just like old school would have been somebody would make sure you don't carry cash, that you have to go to the ATM to get cash out before you buy cigarettes or something like that.
Now it's the opposite. Only bring cash with you.
Yeah, maybe it's old school. Yeah, in a way. Well, but you know what? Also spending limits on credit cards or whatever you can do, the external controls. But when we go back to, let's just say the behavioral goal and all the other things, you have the credit card things, everything there. Yes, it does take a bit of self-monitoring, which can be a weak point. And again, it's because it's such a common behavior, because there are many going food shopping or, you know, buying gas or necessary purchases we're making throughout the day. But if we can highlight a few, especially the high risk ones, and this is a nice concise takeaway. So let's just say it is about, we're targeting online spending. And this is a literature not developed specific for ADHD, but it's called Implementation Intention Strategies. And pretty much the theory behind it is, it's a little bit of like rehearsal, cognitive rehearsal about situations you will find yourself in, and developing an if X, then Y coping statement. There's been some lab-based studies on children with ADHD that have found this to be effective. It's, if I face situation X, then I can respond with goal-focused behavior Y. And it's very well established in the self-regulation literature. All the books, the recent popular books, and they're all very good on willpower, all cite this. Peter Galwitzer is the main researcher who developed this and has a whole team of people and mentees who have gone on to very good careers in their own right. The goal would be, if I log on to Amazon, then I can put things in the cart or save till later until, you know, I can wait 24 hours. Now, it's a verbal rule. We can say, the heck with it, Dr. Ramsey, I want this now. But having and rehearsing for some of the strategies or for some of the situations, it could be overspending at the supermarket or it, you know, whatever the case may be. But if I encounter or when I encounter situation X, then I will respond with goal-focused behavior Y. It could be if I find myself logging on, I'm going to X out. It could be I'm going to look at my bank account before I make a purchase. I'm going to check with one other person, save for later. Whatever the behavior is, the analogy would be somebody looking to change, you know, lose weight. So part of the theory behind this was it started with having a goal focus. I want to lose 10 pounds or I want to spend less. And some people can do okay with that. It guides the micro behaviors in specific situations. But for some people, it's too far away. The goal, they want the goal, but it's too broad, vague, and nonspecific or divorced from the situation. So these are these molecular points that we're at. If I'm asked what I want for dessert, I will order tea or the fruit cup or something like that. Now, we could always say, no, I'll order death by chocolate. But this has been found to be a very concise, useful takeaway. And part of the theory is the environment, the context becomes a cue for coping. It's very simple, straightforward. The self-disclosure I use on this, well, I use all the strategies because even though to my knowledge, I don't have ADHD, I've gotten so much more efficient, like trying to help people and find out what works and why it works. And my thing is, like, it happens to be a beautiful spring day where I'm at today, and it would be a great day for a bike ride outside, but I could talk myself out of a bike ride outside. I should do this. I'm tired. I don't feel like it. I'll have to go all the way to the place where I'd like to go for the ride. But I say, if I put air in my tires, then I can go out for a bike ride because it makes me touch the bike. And now I'm dealing with the bike and reality rather than the concept of it, where I can awfulize and justify not going, just like people can justify an expense. Hey, I really need this. Or I'll use this someday. This is good. But if we have that thing, if this, then that, it makes us confront that. And in the specific situation where we're actually going to buy this, it's like, okay, let me put it in the cart or save for later and let me think about it. And then we may be able to come up with other ways to either one, we don't need it, or maybe other ways to obtain it. Hey, my birthday's coming up. I'll ask for this for a gift from somebody.
Yeah, that's really a good idea. And it got me thinking how, like, I was picturing myself also going into my garage and touching my bike. And I know the tires are flat. And I feel like just in that moment, because then you're grounded in reality, you're doing something with the bike, you may find yourself on that bike biking. And I've been telling myself, I want to get my bike out of the garage. It's been sitting there for 2 years and I haven't done it. And I just keep thinking, like, well, maybe I will, maybe I won't. But like, if I just go into the garage, touch the bike, take the bike off the shelf, then next thing you know, biking doesn't seem so hard.
Yeah. We start a launch sequence. And even that, even if it would be, if I put my bike in my car, I can take it to the local bike shop. And because I still don't know how to fix a flat, even though I'm an avid rider, I'm not the handiest guy. So it'd be, if I could put it in there, I can take it to the bike shop and get it fixed. It doesn't guarantee you could just have a very well repaired bike in your garage and not ride it, but you just exponentially increase the likelihood. And because getting out of our head and into reality, thoughts, feelings, behaviors, they're like this braided cord. So cognitive behavioral therapy, I think what it brought to the table when Dr. Beck introduced it as a treatment for depression is before the main therapy models of the time were psychoanalysis, which let's just say that was more emotional, and the strict behaviorism, which was more strictly behavior, and introducing the role of our thoughts. Now, thoughts don't cause everything, but they can be a useful entry point, just like changing behaviors can change our attitudes and our thoughts and feelings, and recognizing what our feelings are, you know, feelings about finances and money and what it means to us. And that could trigger feelings of anxiety, which is dealing with uncertainty. And I've worked with people with ADHD. Maybe the parent was a gambler or somehow were spending behind the back and a car was repossessed from the parking lot, which was really traumatic. And then all of a sudden, finances in their adulthood was dealt with risk. Well, am I going to lose my job? What if there's another economic downturn? And I know there are some realities that people go through that. For somebody else, it might be guilt. Well, how can I justify spending this? And maybe they came from, with a family who didn't have a lot and had to be very frugal and do without, which is exactly what it was needed. But then later on, this person, and I've dealt with somebody who said, now it's probably better for me if I would hire somebody to do my lawn so I could make more money as an attorney, spending that 2 hours working on a case. But I feel bad. I should be able to mow my own lawn because, you know, the family rule might be, no, you have to do for yourself, which was the exact right rule for that family. And if this person said, no, I want to do this, this is a way for me to get outside, get some exercise, great. But if they go, you know, this is right, but it would be more of a guilt reaction, like, you're not allowed to spend on this. This is where the people on the other side of town, that's what they do. And this gets at work and other matters, like our sense of self. So, you know, briefly, and this is more like the overarching thing, you know, we are not our income. We're not the letters behind our name or whatever, however far we got in school. These things don't define us. But I think what ADHD does, it gets in the way of following through on intentions and plans, and plans that of our design for an outcome we want. Now, not everything works out. We might say, I don't know, I don't know where this one's coming from. This is why I'm not in psychoanalysis. I want to learn the square dance, but I'm not good at it. So, all right, I took the class, but I don't want to do that anymore. All right, that's a decision we're making. That's an informed decision. But ADHD punctuates a lot of plans and then may lead to us to abandon them and say, well, I can't do that, without really knowing for sure. So that's the other thing with ADHD, is it gets at our sense of self, like, oh, I failed, or I can't do that, or this doesn't work for me. That's another part we're trying to turn around.
Alrighty, and just like that, we are now done with interview number 2. Next week, we'll have the third and final piece of the interview with Dr. Russell Ramsey. I hope you enjoyed this, and I look forward to talking to you next week. See you then.